Welcome to the Holy Donors Podcast. Join Andrew, Matt, Ren, and me, Thaddeus, as every week we bring you inspiring stories of radical generosity that have changed the world. So, Andrew, you ready to get started?
Can't wait.
We ended last episode with Catherine's adopted mother dying and her father and two sisters going on a trip west, where they had this encounter that put a spotlight on this massive gap between the rich and the poor.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this massive gap shows up in a time when she has everything she ever wanted. Anything she wants, she's got. She's living in the lap of luxury, yet she is seeing this great empathy for people who don't have basic necessities.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
So Catherine's reeling from her stepmom's death. And then on February 1st, 1885, Frances came down with a chill that became more serious. And Kate, Catherine, so as we're going along, we're seeing new names that she's being called, and her sister, Lise, Lizzie, they were the nurses around the clock for their dad to kind of help nurse them back together. But on February 15th, she was reading, he was reading, he put his glasses away, and he slumped in his chair, and she jumped to her feet yelling, "Papa, Papa." And he didn't respond. She booked it out the door to go get a priest for last rites. But by the time she made it back, he had already passed away before he could receive that. And that was a big blow in her faith to receive last rites.
It's taking me back to John Raskob, remember from season two?
Oh, yeah.
When his father was ill and he got sent out for the doctor. And by the time he got back, his dad had passed away. And
right.
How this was kind of a driving force for the rest of his life. Did it have a similar effect on Catherine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a moment in her life where she lost her North Star. She lost her way. She didn't know what she wanted to do next. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what she wanted to do with the rest of her life. And so from the moment of her dad's death forward, she was going to struggle to figure out, okay, what am I supposed to do with my life?
And there's also she asked some of the servants about what he had said, right? There's a story
Yeah. So she went to the servants and she said, what did he say? And either they didn't know or they wouldn't tell her. And again, this was another mystery in her eyes. She wanted to know so desperately, what was his last words?
Yeah. I mean, she's already struggling with this as a teenager, finding out that her mother passed away after childbirth and they kept that from her, right? So there's a moment of self-doubt. And then later, now her father dies, passes away, and nobody will tell her if he said anything.
Yeah.
Again, for right or wrong, perception is reality. And sometimes we perceive the worst case, and it sort of drives this doubt in our life. So,
yeah. So he passed away, and she's reeling from this. And as we've kind of built this up from last episode, if you remember, Frank was a very wealthy man.
Right.
He was very wealthy. And after his wife's death, he set up a trust in case something happened to him so that his daughters would be set up. He had set it up, the estate, which was $15.5 million, which is about $436 million today. Yeah, a lot of money. Where one-tenth of it went to 29 different organizations. And nine-tenths was split equally among the three sisters. But Andrew, you looked a lot further into this than I did.
Yes, yeah, so it was set up so that the principal could not be touched in the trust, right? They could only spend the earnings from that money. They didn't get a lump sum. So it's not like they got $135 million that was paid out annually over time. And if one of the trust beneficiary dies, so one of the sisters dies, her share gets equally divided between the other two sisters. If two sisters pass away, then the one sister gets it. And if all of them pass away, then it goes to their children. And then if all of their children are gone, then eventually it goes out to these 29 organizations. So there's a lot of thought put into this trust to protect it, but also to protect the sisters, right? He didn't want to make them all just super wealthy immediately because he kind of wanted to protect their integrity and to protect suitors from coming after these young women just for their money, right?
And I think there was another piece to it, too. He wanted to make sure that their way of life was kept, yeah. That for the rest of their lives, they would be set up to live a similar life to what they were used to. And so that was another big piece to it, so that they wouldn't go out and spend a lot of the money and keep it saved so that they could live the rest of their life similar to how they had been.
Yeah. I mean, more than just the money. Now, you've got three young girls who have no parents, right?
Right. No parents. And I mentioned she lost her North Star. He didn't know where to go. But there was a family friend, Bishop O'Connor. She had known him for a long time. They kind of became, for lack of a better word, pen pals, kind of buddies in that sense. And they would write letters back and forth, spiritual letters in a sense of, okay, what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? And one of the great things that came from that was this discernment process that she started. What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to become a nun? Because she was thinking, there are three options. I'm going to be single the rest of my life.
Right.
I'm going to become a nun, which means cloistered, which means you go off somewhere and you don't have outside world communication. Or she was going to get married and become a mother, you know, and start a family like Emma. And so she went through all this, and there was this back and forth discernment process between it. And this went on for like 6 years.
So guys, I'm going to jump in. I want to ask a question here. Catherine's dad passes away. He left with three sisters in their 20s who each are essentially worth more than $100 million apiece. What emotional state did that leave them in? Some people would think, oh, I've got all this money. Life is great. I'm young and single. Her dad passed away. That's sad. Like, what's the mental state here?
She was depressed. Again, she lost her North Star. She lost both of her parents. Even though Emma was a stepmother, she was her mother. She was depressed and struggling with that. But also on the same thing, a piece that everybody around her didn't know. They just saw her getting sicker and sicker and sicker. But what they didn't realize is that she was actually fasting during this time.
Wow.
She was trying to discern what was next. And one of the paths that she took was to fast. Funny thing with Bishop O'Connor is that Bishop O'Connor told her she was doing it too much.
Yeah, there is a sin of scrupulosity, right?
Yeah.
Going too far
down
this road of fasting and other self-denials.
And you'll find out in the story of Catherine that she sometimes took it too far.
Yeah.
And at this time, she was sickly. Today, she would have been diagnosed with anorexia. But what she was doing is she was fasting so much and not eating that she became anorexic from the amount of fasting she was doing. In this discernment process.
Well, so Matt, you're saying she's sad and because she lost her North Star. It's also possible that she's kind of holding some guilt for leaving her father, you know, like, you know, in a moment of grief and when you're young, and it sounds like they had led a fairly sheltered life outside of, you know, these interactions. Emma brought people into the home, but it's entirely possible. Maybe she kind of was feeling depressed because she had let her father down, right?
Yeah. And couldn't make it up.
Yeah. So what happens next?
There's something that draws her back to the West. And she learns about the Indian missions.
Yeah. I mean, the Catholic Church had been establishing educational and religious missions going all the way back to the arrival of the Europeans in South and North America. And these are just kind of 19th century descendants of that.
Yeah.
It's coming out of that same tradition of bringing the Catholic faith to the native peoples.
Yes.
These just happen to be ones that were brought onto reservations.
It's only been, the peace policy was
probably like 1866 to 18.
So we're talking about less than 20 years that 68. Native Americans have been on reservations.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of still new to the American public.
This idea of a peace policy from Grant's administration's perspective was, we're going to create peace by putting the Indians all in one place that the whites presumably don't want. And so then there won't be any more conflict between whites and native peoples. And so then there will be peace.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a outreach. We're going to negotiate with you and come to kind of a common, you know, agreement of how we're going to live together.
So then the church is seeing this and saying, how can we minister? How can we be missioned to?
Like so often, like we're going to see with Pope Pius XII in World War II, it's okay, we got to make the best out of a bad situation.
So somewhere in there, you've got Bishop O'Connor who knows about these missions, the need. He's communicating with Catherine Drexel. He sees Catherine kind of going through this discernment period. And there's a story that he actually sends two priests to meet with Catherine Drexel to try to secure some money for their programs, but also probably at some level to give Catherine kind of something to focus her attention on, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Andrew. Two priests show up at the Drexel house in Philadelphia, knock on the door. The sisters let them in. They hear from them. And the whole mission of serving the natives gets Catherine especially really excited. So she immediately decides to give them $3,000, which is about $80,000 today.
Yeah.
On the spot, right? So that's pretty good. And she gets really interested in this entire subject, and she starts looking into it, especially when it comes to building schools for the natives at different reservations. And she even pretty quickly after that starts commissioning architects to design schools to build, right? But as she digs even further, she finds the hard part isn't building the schools, it's staffing the schools. Because these reservations are on the frontier,
yeah,
right? They're way out there. It's essentially living in poverty in very remote areas around the Western United States. And so she spends some time traveling to different religious orders, asking them to send missionaries. And this becomes kind of the big struggle for the next several years, is how are we going to find people to staff those schools?
So while that's going on, then 1886 comes along and Catherine's sister says, let's go back to Europe.
Yeah. And really, during this time, she is in the throngs of discerning what's next. She's met with Bishop O'Connor's priests about Indian missions, and she's in love with these Indian missions. She goes to Europe. She's still depressed. She's still trying to discern. She's trying to figure out her way in life. And they get another meeting with the Pope. And while she's meeting with the Pope, they have this awesome conversation. And she asks him, why don't you send missionaries to help with these Indian schools in America? And the Pope quickly rebuttals her and says, why not, my child, yourself become a missionary?
So this is very similar to the story out of Matthew 19, where the rich man comes to Jesus and says, I've kept all the commandments. I've done everything right. How do I get into heaven? And Jesus says, well, sell everything that you have and give it to the poor and come follow me. And when the young man heard this, he went away in sorrow because he had great wealth. And then that's when Jesus tells the disciples, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. So was that Catherine's reaction to Pope Leo saying that?
Actually, I think it's the complete opposite. I think what she is saying is, let's go. Let's do it. But again, she's still trying to figure out, what does that mean?
Yeah.
What is this, let's go? Am I supposed to get married or am I supposed to become a nun? What am I supposed to do?
So they get back from Europe and she has this really powerful meeting with Pope Leo, and they get back to the United States. And Ren, what do they do next?
They really start looking into serving the native missions. Bishop O'Connor invites them out to Nebraska and says, hey, let's go tour some of these missions and get to know what the mission is all about. And you can see it for yourself and we can go from there. And it's going to be on horseback. We're going to be riding wagons. It's going to be a little bit rough. And the sisters say, oh, we have a country estate where we have ridden horses all of our lives. No problem. So the sisters, Catherine and her two sisters, show up in Omaha. They take the train out there and they go riding 30 to 60 miles every day for a couple of weeks from one mission to another across the Dakotas and Nebraska and see for themselves what it's like. And it feels like a scene from a movie. You've got these three Philadelphia women who have, it says, they're wearing bonnets, they're wearing jewelry, lacy gloves, and you know, the fancy saddles. And you're going around to these places on the out in the open plains in the Dakotas, and it's rough land. The communities are poverty-stricken. There are some of the only white people around, right? The few that are there are rougher characters. This is like Calamity Jane was one of the only well-known white women in the area at the time. So it's just an interesting juxtaposition of they're still kind of learning to maybe assimilate a little bit more to where they are.
So, Matt, how are they received?
So, at first, they're not received very well. I mean, everybody kind of stands off.
Yeah.
And so, as they start moving through and getting closer to the Native American people, they become friends with chiefs and those of need within it, and they fall in love with them to the point where they were like, we want to help. We're going to build the missions. And they said $30,000 we're going to give you to start these missions.
This is Catherine saying this?
This is Catherine and her sister saying this.
Do you think that they saw in those Indians the faces of all those people that had tromped through their home?
I think they did. I think this is a beautiful part of Catherine, is that she didn't see people and her sisters. She didn't see in color. She saw humans as humans. So she saw the Indian people as humans. She saw African Americans humans as they are, not as somebody that needs to be moved or changed, but as people. And going further along this, as she does these schools, she's not trying to force Catholicism on anybody. She just wants to give them a school to learn, to help. She loves her Catholic faith, but she wasn't forcing. So that's down the road. But this is something that I think she saw herself as Emma at that point in time. She wanted to help. She wanted to do something before it was too late. And that's where it came in.
This conference is well worth the entire experience, especially for the faithful looking to build the body of Christ. That's what one ministry director said after attending the Petrus Development's RAISE conference in 2023. A fundraising staff member from a different organization had this to say: I have several years of experience fundraising, and I found the conference applicable to me. I also saw new to fundraising people getting a lot out of it too. There is literally something for everyone here. In 2024, RAISE, the Catholic Fundraising Conference, will be even bigger and even better. Join us on the Riverwalk in San Antonio, Texas, June 24 through 26, 2024. RAISE 24 will feature outstanding speakers, great networking opportunities, and an authentically Catholic conference experience. Registration is open now. Learn more at petrusdevelopment.com/raise24. That's petrusdevelopment.com/raise24.
So she's still discerning religious life, hasn't made a decision on that, but now she knows she wants to build more schools.
Yeah, that's correct. She really saw the building of the schools as like a one-time thing she would do and then go join religious life.
Mm.
She had hired architects. They're building schools kind of all over the country. It's not really clear how she heard about all these different places. Just to give you an example, she had architects designing schools for the Lakota, the Chippewa, the Crow, the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, and the Blackfeet in the Dakotas. The Coeur d'Alene and Nez Perce in Idaho, the Cherokee, Comanche, and Osage in the Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma. It was still called the Indian Territory at the time, and the Pueblo in New Mexico. So lots of different tribes, lots of different reservations kind of across the West. Pretty impressive. But her plan was actually to build the schools and then deed them over to the Catholic Indian Bureau, almost like, let's make this happen and then give it to them to run, and then I can go join religious life. And she assumed at the time that she's just going to go live in the convent, probably cloistered. And that was kind of the end of her job.
But like you said earlier, the challenge, you know, at this point, wasn't necessarily building the buildings. It was the staff, right?
Right. Yep. That still persisted as the main problem.
There's another problem too. Bishop O'Connor. Because she had given obedience to Bishop O'Connor for a full year at this point in time.
Oh, well.
And she had done this for a few years. Every year she kept going as she was discerning this. And he was saying, no, you can't do it. Mm. So we've got staffing issues. We have Bishop O'Connor. And so she, again, is trying to decide, what am I supposed to do? And she comes up with a list, a pros and cons list. Why she should become a nun, why she shouldn't become a nun, why she should be a wife, and why she shouldn't be a wife.
So I read a little bit about the pros and cons list. Can I share?
Yeah, go ahead.
So her reasons for entering religious life, she had 8 reasons on here. The first one is, Jesus Christ has given his life for me. It is but just that I should give him mine. Now in religions, we offer ourselves to God in a direct manner, whereas in the married state, natural motives prompt us to sacrifice self. So basically, that kind of sums up all the other 8 reasons in that God is good, and I love Jesus, and this is the best way that I can serve him.
Yeah, and I think what's fascinating about those 8 reasons are that they are so focused, laser-focused almost. Well, that's an anachronism. They didn't have lasers in 1890, but anyway, on the afterlife, on the eternal. Her eyes are raised to heaven. They're not about social do-gooderism or feeling good like I'm being a really holy person. It's about, this is what Christ has done for me, and so I need to imitate him so that I can spend the rest of eternity with him in heaven.
You know what I'm wondering, now that you're saying that, is kind of a point that Matt made earlier. You know, when she was building these schools, it wasn't a requirement that these students become Catholic, right? That was the hope, obviously, if she's motivated by that. But I'm wondering if she almost kind of separated this decision to enter religious life and then do good. Like, she could do good outside of her faith. That's what Emma had taught her. That's what she had experienced. And so her reasons for entering religious life were really, well, I can continue to do good, but if I'm going to choose religious life, then it really needs to be because my eyes are focused on Christ.
I mean, I think that fits in very well with what Ren gave us, that she was thinking, oh, I'm going to build all these schools and then we're going to deed them over to the Catholic Indian Bureau. And then I'm going to step out and go pursue religious life. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Andrew, you did a great job of kind of summarizing these pros lists, right? I know what the cons list is, so I'm curious how you quickly summarize those.
Okay. So again, she had about eight objections to entering religious life. And they were essentially this: I'll miss my family. I don't like living with strangers. I might not like my boss, especially if she's stupid. And sacrifice in the religious life is really tough. There you go. I mean, those are pretty sound objections, I would say, right?
Yeah, you may have oversimplified it just a tad.
Okay, but she did use the word stupid. I didn't add that.
Hey, so if you're listening, I would suggest tune into our Instagram account. This is a plug for it. We'll have what she actually wrote for pros and cons.
I mean, I like my version, but
so
that's
you could double check
Andrew's
list there.
Yeah, and just another quick observation. Notice that all of those reasons were all here and now material world, human interaction based objections.
You know, it's interesting you caught that because Bishop O'Connor, that's what he was saying back to her. It's like, all your cons have nothing to do with serving people on this world. It has everything to do with holiness, which is great, but you can do all that as a married mother. But all your cons have something to do with religious life, which point to you probably shouldn't go, and you should probably become, you know, get married and have a family. That's what he was pushing back on her.
So Bishop O'Connor seems to be kind of pushing back on her wanting to join religious life, using her list of objections as objections, right? So what happens next with them?
There is a decision right around this time in her life, too, where a gentleman approaches her. We're not sure who it was, but she's actually proposed to. And she turns the guy down and says, no, I'm going to remain a, quote, old maid. The only person that knew about this was Bishop O'Connor. Not even her family knew about it at the time, which is interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So Bishop O'Connor is a no. Pointing her and pushing her towards having a family, getting married, turned down a suitor, and then Catherine does something a little bit outside of herself. You know, this has been going on for 6 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has been saying, do I become a nun? Do I get married? For 6 years. So she's in her upper 20s, early 30s at this point in time, still trying to figure out what to do with her life. And she decides the obedience that she had given to Bishop O'Connor was done. And she decides on her own that she is going to become a nun.
Oh, snap.
But when she tells Bishop O'Connor that this is her decision, like, it's done, I've made it, it's my decision to make, this is what I want to do, I'm going to do it. He takes a moment and writes her back and says, okay, I think you should, but I have a better idea for you. Mm. Something that you haven't thought of yet.
What was it?
I can't tell you till the next episode.
Oh, well, in that case, I can't wait.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Holy Donors, brought to you by Petrus Development in cooperation with Red Sea Catholic Radio and Back Row Media. Theme music by Tommy Kibb, Third Top Productions. Graphics by 86 Creative. If you like us, leave us a review, share us with your friends, and check us out at holydonors.com and on Instagram at Holy Donors. Holy Donors, bringing you inspiring stories of radical generosity that have changed the world.
I feel like this is going to get a little silly. I'm kind of in a little bit of a silly mood right now.
When does a joke become a dad joke?
I don't know.
When it becomes apparent.
I thought it was when it laughs at itself.
Oh, I know.
Hey, let me talk.
It'd be amazing.
I can't understate.
Okay.
How do I follow that?
You're not giving us what we need here, Andrew.
My wife is really mad at the fact that I have no sense of direction. So I packed up my stuff and write.
Nice.